Log Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us once again on Queensbury Rules Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of QueensburyRules.com, and with me is James Foley of BadLeftHook.com. James.
How you doing?
I'm doing, dude. You know, I'd like to be hating. I'd like some reason to complain, but I don't have any because the last weekend was awesome.
Yeah, it was. That was pretty pretty good one, man. Unexpected. And we're just getting into the, you know, this hot stretch coming up.
It was supposed to be all low-key and stuff, and it did not wind up being low-key at all. It was a damn fine boxing weekend, I must say.
Yeah, I also was hoping you could go back and delete last week's episode. I think every prediction that I made was wrong. But
no,
I'm not unhappy about
just,
it.
That's just how we're going to roll with it.
Yeah.
But I want you to actually tell us about how the Friday Night Fights card was, because I know you went to that, so hook it up, some details.
Well, I mean, I think it was obviously a rousing success for those guys. It was, to me, kind of a bold move for them to, you know, lease out the U.S. Cellular Field, which I hate calling it that, by the way, because it's always Comiskey Park from our point of view. But you know, it was a bold play, man. I mean, an event headlined by Fonfara and Campillo, and you're putting it in a stadium that I think has like a 40,000 capacity, and you know they cordoned it off for about 16, I believe, and I guess the fight drew over 8,000 people, which I think is pretty good. But more importantly, you know, the event delivered. I mean, it got a really good response from the television audience. It seemed like I know a lot of people were saying they think it was one of the best Friday night fights they can remember. I think that the atmosphere at the event definitely contributed to that. But, you know, more importantly, I mean, all three fights turned out to be pretty great, pretty good, you know, good to great. I thought the Granados fight, Adrian Granados against Mark Salser. Is that what the guy's name is? Mark?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
Mark Salser Jr., I think it was.
Yeah, I mean, that was...
Mike Salser.
Mike Salser?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, well, we're never going to need to know that guy's
name.
Well, anyway,
go ahead. We're splitting hairs here.
Yeah, I think that, I wouldn't mind seeing a rematch of that. You know, I thought that was probably the fight of the night. It was just, you know, a ton of drama there. And you know, Granados was down twice, and then Salser was knocked down twice and didn't get up the second time. You know, the Spilka-Malo rematch, I think, turned out as well as it could have. You know, I was worried that a lot of times, you know, something like that happens, and the favorite kind of gets it together, which would be Spilka, and maybe wins more, you know, decisively and without as much drama the second time. But, you know, that didn't happen. I mean, he took a big punch and went down. And then, you know, the main event was interesting. I was pretty stunned about what unfolded, because I thought Campillo was just dominating that fight up to that point. So I'm curious to get your thoughts, but I also want to say that, you know, where I was at was up in basically like the 400 level in the press box, and there was, I mean, for me, it's like I was watching it on a TV monitor the entire time, so I didn't really get the experience of, you know, being in the crowd, and it looked very intense. But, you know, I think we probably had a similar perspective on the fights. You know, the fact that I happened to be in the stadium, you know, I was still basically indoors watching it on a television set, so. I didn't get Tessitore Atlas commentary, but other than that, I think we probably had about the same view.
Well, yeah, I was going to actually ask you about like how the atmosphere was, but it sounds like you weren't really in the thick of it for the most part. But I mean, from television, from where I was watching, I had to catch up on it a little bit late because I was just friggin' worn out from work, but I did catch up with it. And, I actually thought I was a lot later than I was, but I tuned in, and what they had done on ESPN2, at least where I was they replayed the first fight of the first Spilka-Malo fight.
Yeah, they
and
did that.
So
in
I was watching
too,
that.
By the way,
yeah, I was sitting there watching that and going like, this looks. Wait, what? I don't wait. this second fight is a hell of a lot like the first fight. And it actually did wind up being like the first fight, but I didn't realize at first that it was the first fight I was watching. But I mean, yeah, I would tend to agree that, you know, Tim Stark's Queensbury Rules guru basically said that he thought it was, you know, if not the best Friday night fights card he can remember, certainly one of them. And I would probably agree. It was damn good.
Yeah, there wasn't really a weak moment in it. You know, I think the main event was shaping up to be kind of the weak link of the three televised fights, but the way that it ended, you know, it was certainly memorable, and the, you know, the tables were turned. So, you know, I mean, Fanfara really, you know, salvaged his career by coming back and catching Campillo the way that he did. It looked like he caught him with a right hand to the chin at the end of the eighth round, kind of stunned him a little bit. Maybe it might have been on, like, more on the side of the head. And then, you know, I think it was a couple punches to the head and then a body shot that actually put him down for good in the ninth. But,
yeah,
you know, really, really surprising. You know, I didn't see that coming. I thought if Fanfara was going to knock him out, it would have happened early. And it just seemed like Campillo took control of the fight. One of the downsides is, of course, you had a little Chicago scoring, and Fanfara was somehow leading 5-3 on one of the judges' scorecards. And even the other two that had it 5-3 the other way, I thought were maybe a bit close. But, you know, he got the knockout, so ultimately that didn't matter.
Well, I actually wanted to kind of, like, talk about the fights, you know, somewhat one by one, all because
I think it's good enough, I think. I think so.
And I was going to ask you, like, in terms of crowd response, did Spielka Malo 2 seem to get the best crowd response, like, overall?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine. I had, you know, a group of buddies who were all sitting down in the bottom section, and I went down there and was hanging out with them for a little bit before the televised portion. So the crowd was kind of just filling in. And part of the problem with, from my vantage point up top, I could see the entire stadium, you know, so it didn't look as full as it did because half the stadium wasn't, you know, there wasn't even available seating there. So, you know, it didn't look as good. When you went down in kind of, the, you know, the front section, that 100 level of seats, you know, you're basically in a throng of Polish fans, and mostly Polish fans, and some other, you know, smaller contingencies. Like, there's a Malo cheering section, and I think that the Spielka Malo fight probably did get the biggest response, you know, during the fight and at the end of it. The Fanfara fight, you know, I think the crowd knew what was going on, and the ending happened so fast that, yeah, I mean, it went from kind of, you know, this nervous silence to, you know, euphoric celebration at the end of it. But I still think that, the Spielka fight, you know, and he's a guy I think is a lot more charismatic than Fanfara. I was talking to you know, with my friend about this, too. I don't think Spielka is with 8-Count Promotions, but he seems like a guy that could definitely be headlining cards on his own and made into kind of a star himself, because he has a rabid following too. And I think he's also just kind of more of a compelling character. Fanfara might be the better fighter, but yeah. So, yeah, long answer. I think that got that probably got the best response. The sad thing is that the Granados fight in the middle, that was kind of like, you know, half the crowd went on smoke break or something. I mean, that had the least response by far. I think that eventually, because it was such a good fight, you know, it started to get a little bit of buzz. But for the first few rounds of that Adrian Granados fight, it was like everybody, all the Spielka fans had left and were waiting for the main event to start or something, which is kind of unfortunate.
In a couple of angles on Friday night fights, like on a couple of camera angles, you could see that, like, an entire, like, side, there were no fans at all, and it was kind of blocked off. But regardless, you know, it was still kind of cool to see that, you know, there was a at least decent turnout. And, I mean, it looked like a lively crowd on TV anyway.
I think they should be happy with it, man. I mean, I heard that they, you know, it was over 8,000 people, 8,000 tickets. So I think that's a really good number. I mean, it's almost double what Fanfara had done before at UIC.
Well, that's a pretty damn good number in general. I mean, there aren't a lot of places where you're going to be drawing over 5,000, you know, outside of Vegas or maybe Atlantic City or, you know, perhaps Madison Square Garden for certain fighters. and stuff like that. So, I mean, if you're drawing over 5,000 and, you know, especially in a ballpark, I think that that's pretty cool. How were the ticket prices?
They were good. You know, my friends paid $62, and they were down in the 100 section, and it was a pretty good view. I think the ringsides were, like, just a little bit over 100. And then it was something like $30 for the, like, upper deck, front section of the upper deck.
See, now that's exactly how they have to do it. They have to have a local appeal, you know, with fighters that are going to bring people from, you know, around the area with at least reasonable ticket prices. This is exactly how we get boxing back to, you know, a more local level, and I think that's where it tends to thrive.
These guys have done a great job at the UIC Pavilion, too, promoting shows and kind of, you know, building awareness that there are fights going on in the city. And, you know, like I said, I think last week I overstated it a little bit, but Fanfara had previously drawn, I think his high was like 4,600 people, but a few times had gotten over 4,000 fans at UIC. And they do a great job. I mean, it's $25. It's basically open seating beyond, like, the initial ringside section. So once you get into that, and it's a basketball arena. So when you're in that first tier of seats, like, off the floor, it's just $25 general admission. So if you show up early, I mean, you're sitting, like, 30, 40 feet from the ring for $25.
Yeah.
You know, so they do a great job with the price points, too. And that's another thing I was worried about with this card is would they raise them up, you know, because I'm sure it's a more expensive lease and just more expensive to do a fight, you know, at a baseball stadium. And they really didn't that much, you know. They were still in that same range that I think is much more affordable and palatable for people.
And it was money well spent, too, because, I mean, at the end of the day, the fights were good. And I think that if you expose people to, you know, a lot of people, you know, perhaps aren't used to having, you know, guys, local guys to root for and go and watch fights for, you know, an affordable price. And that's the exact type of card where somebody would sit there and watch it and think, I want to go to another one.
Exactly.
Well, as far as the Spilka-Mallo fight, I mean, there's not really a ton to say that they didn't say in the ring. I mean, it was almost a mirror of the first fight, and Mike Mallo looked like he maybe was even a little bit more determined than in the first fight to make something happen. But at the end of the day, I think that it's pretty clear that, you know, no offense to Mike Mallo, because he two times fought his ass off, but he's kind of a middle-of-the-road type of guy, more of a gatekeeper than anything. And Spilka passed both tests, but just barely. So I'm not really sure how much money they're going to be wanting to invest into him on a, you know, world-class level. But even if he were to stay close to home or, you know, close to Chicago and putting on these types of shows, I think that would be perfect, you know, both for his career and in terms of what he's capable of. So,
and that, you know, when,
that was
what,
enjoyable.
Yeah, and I think Spilka's fought twice in Europe since that first fight with Mallo, which was earlier this year. So staying active. I mean, he's a fun guy. You know, he's a fun fighter to watch. And he's still undefeated, so eventually he's going to, you know, get up and take a bigger test and probably not, you know. I think he has a way to go before he can really compete on that level, if he ever will. But he's a guy that will definitely tune in to watch.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the bottom line, is that, I mean, maybe he does wind up getting pounded by, you know, somebody in the top 3 to 5 at heavyweight. And that's fine. Just about everybody outside of the top 3 to 5 of heavyweight is going to get pounded by those guys because that's just how the division stacks up right now. But regardless, I'm probably going to be watching, you know, Artur Spilka fight again if that's the case. As far as Adrian Granados, I mean, we actually did bring up that fight with Kermit Cintron. You brought it up last week. I had totally forgotten about it, but it was a fight that, you know, just about everybody who watched that I can remember thought that Adrian Granados deserved a win over Kermit Cintron for whatever that's worth these days. But, you know, I just got the feeling from that fight, and like you were saying, I'm not sure how close everyone was watching it while there, but it was funny because even though Granados got knocked down twice, the entire time he didn't really look very hurt. He almost looked like disappointed that he had gotten knocked down. And
I think he looked like he was badly hurt after the first knockdown.
After the first knockdown, his legs didn't look great, but he recovered fairly quickly. And the look in his face was like, he was just kind of like, I don't even know how that happened, but I'm just going to go right at this guy. Because
yeah,
he
once
really
he once
stop,
once
you know?
He once he regained consciousness, he looked like he was okay.
Like, well, he just didn't.
I mean,
he didn't
I thought
stop.
He was
basically
I
came
thought he
forward.
Was bad. Yeah, I thought he was really badly hurt after the first knockdown. I think he was in worse shape to continue than Mahlo was when they stopped that fight. I mean, he stumbled face first into the ring and then bounced off. But you're right. I mean, after that, he did recover pretty quickly. And then the second knockdown, I think it was more of a flash kind of knockdown. He wasn't badly hurt then, but he got caught being reckless. It was an interesting fight. I mean, I think he obviously, looking at those two guys prior to the fight, just in street clothes, Salser is the much more menacing, kind of intimidating guy, a lot thicker, and he had an undefeated record, but hadn't fought. I mean, had been fighting at a pretty low level. I think he's from Ohio or something like that. And Granados is kind of skinny, wiry guy with a, big smile. And it really early on, I mean, it was obvious Granados is just a better boxer than Salser. But the problem is he just was getting too reckless, and it didn't look like he had the power to really hurt him. He was just kind of swarming him with activity, and then he got get caught with this huge counterpunch in the middle of his own assault. But apparently he did have the power, right? Because he came back and caught Salser with a body shot that he never really recovered from and stopped him. So it's a big win for him, and I think it's a memorable fight that people. Going forward, I think he's going to be back on ESPN2 level. And I also heard that he's going to be a sparring partner for Adrian Broner.
Well, that first knockdown, it was like he was caught right in the middle of throwing. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I'm not saying he wasn't hurt, but to me it looked like he had almost just kind of surprised him as much as anything else. And his legs looked like they were kind of gone there for a second, but then as soon as he kind of like, got his bearings about him, it's kind of, you look at the type of fighters who are just kind of like, smacking their gloves together and like, fuck it, let's go. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of fans just kind of have a type of admiration for those types of fighters who hurt or not, or, whether they're going to get hit or not, or just kind of like, let's throw. So,
yeah, he went right back to work.
Yeah, the grin on his face, like you said, he pretty much had that grin anytime he was hit. It's just funny to watch guys like that who just laugh off when they get smacked with a good shot. So there's just something about that appeals to a lot of people, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, as far as where he goes, it's tough to say. That's interesting that he's going to be sparring with Broner, as you said. I'm not really sure what to make of that because, I mean, personally, I don't think super highly of Adrian Broner's skills in general. But
he doesn't seem too similar to the guys that Broner's rumored to be fighting, like Maidana or Soto Karas. Granados seems like he has a quite different style than those guys. Definitely doesn't punch like Maidana.
And he's not quite as refined, I don't think. And I mean, that some people might be hearing that and saying you're not as refined as Maidana, but Maidana has a lot of tricks too. But
well, Maidana's been on a world class level for a couple
years.
Yeah,
exactly. And Granados has not.
Right, and some people in like our boy Brian Fogg from Leave It in the Ring was making comparison between Granados and Carlos Molina, the other Chicago fighter who fought James Kirkland and there's Landy Lara,
yes.
Cintron, and stylistically, they're a lot different. But I think he was kind of saying that Granados could maybe become that kind of a fighter, that kind of workman-like guy who does what he needs to do to win. Won't be great, but could get on that same kind of level as a legitimate contender in his division. I mean, I don't know.
Backstory.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, I guess if you look at the kind of the outlook, the respective outlook in the ring, I guess it's kind of similar. Where that, Carlos Molina is a guy that he's kind of tricky and he's got a weird style, but he's also, like when he gets hurt or if he gets in trouble, he's the type of guy that, is not really unwilling to engage. So I guess I could see that, but yeah, I mean,
what do you think of Molina and Ishae Smith? Do you have an early pick for that?
I would probably favor Ishae Smith. I mean,
really?
He's looked a little bit better as of late, I would say. But, I mean, I think that it's a close fight and kind of tough to pick, just stylistically. It could wind up being kind of ugly. But I don't know. I don't really have a really solid pick. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking I'm favoring Molina pretty big there, just because of what he's done against competition that he's fought the last couple of years, and I think he's had some tough breaks. We were saying the other day how early
tough breaks.
Yeah, and early in his career, how he got a draw against Chavez Jr. in Mexico.
Yeah.
And then I think the rematch might have even been like a split decision for Chavez. So.
Yeah, well, a lot of people feel he should have had two wins over Chavez. I mean, I'm pretty much right there with them.
And also, you know, could have a win over Kirkland, could have a win over Lara. I mean, I thought that fight, I thought Molina beat Arislandi clearly that night.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people, including myself, thought that was a crappy decision. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think that Carlos Molina is a bad fighter by any means, but he's also the type of guy that, you know, like we were just saying, he kind of like finds ways to lose. You know what I mean? Like not that he wants to lose, but he just doesn't really dominate a lot of guys.
Yeah.
And so
he doesn't have much power, but and it, you know, the fight with Kirkland was an ugly fight, but I mean, I was really shocked the way that he just physically manhandled James Kirkland, who's a beast physically at 154. I mean, maybe Kirkland was drained and he didn't have his legs, but I mean, Molina was just pushing him around the ring. You know, walking him backwards.
Yeah,
and
I think that Ishae Smith's just a little bit more talented of a fighter. I've never really been a big fan of his, but you know, he's got good hand speed, and it's a close fight.
Yeah,
so
it's a good fight, I think. Yeah, I think considering we got the two big fights that night, I mean, I think that's a pretty interesting fight.
And
maybe it's
waffling on my pick like three times. So,
well, and the guy who wins, Molina wins that. You know, he's starting to build a pretty impressive resume at junior middleweight, even though he hasn't gotten the decisions. You know, I think he's right there in that top five in that division.
In terms of ability, for sure, I think that on just about any given night, at the very least, he can give a lot of guys in that division issues, if not flat out beat them. So I think that, you know, Molina should be in the mix. But you know, also, Ishae Smith does have a bit to prove. I would have to say. I mean, the belt is good and everything, but yeah, he's got stuff to prove in that division, especially that division, because it hasn't totally thinned out. But
yeah, I mean, he's in a tough position because he's right behind these superstars. He's not going to get a fight with those guys.
Yeah,
he has a difficult
style.
And that's what's funny behind Floyd and Canelo, which is like the marquee fight at junior middleweight. All these next guys like Austin Trout, Arislandi Lara, Carlos Molina. You know, there's not really any terribly appealing styles. But if those guys all fight each other, I mean, whoever can come out of that really, you know, has a mandate for fighting the top guy in the division. Or maybe they are the top guy in the division.
Yeah, I feel bad for a guy like Molina. Because he's got a difficult style. He doesn't really bring a whole lot of money with him and not really a ton of notoriety either if you beat him. I mean, it'll bring kind of like hardcore respect because people will think, yeah, well, you beat Carlos Molina, who's given just about every fighter that he's fought shit over the last couple of years. But I feel bad for him because he probably deserves more opportunities than he's gotten.
Yeah, he's an easy guy to root for because he's earning his place by winning fights and by, you know, doing well in fights, even the ones that he didn't win. And it's great to see him get an opportunity on the, you know, this big pay-per-view undercard and fighting for a belt. And I think, you know, if he wins the fight, he becomes a real player in that division. So.
Yeah, for sure.
So speaking of potential players in divisions, where do you see Andre Fonfara's prospects going from here?
Well, I mean, another guy that we were talking about last week that I also feel kind of bad for at this point is Gabriel Campillo. You know, for fairly obvious reasons. I mean, he's just gotten a handful of really shitty breaks, and you know, he probably could be 2-2 in his last four fights, but rather, or even, you know, 3-2 in his last five because of the draw against Murat. But, you know, he's now in the span of three fights been stopped twice. And that leaves him in a really crappy position, despite being, in my opinion, a pretty solid fighter. I think he showed that in the first, you know, 7 or 8 rounds against Funfara. But as far as Funfara goes, it was a fairly big win. Even though, you know, I was just talking about all the record nonsense with Campillo, and, you know, it doesn't really look that impressive if you look at Campillo's recent record. Regardless, you know, Campillo is a very capable guy. He's skilled. He has quick hands. Despite being not that young, he's, look, at least in stretches, looks to have pretty good legs still. So I would say that Funfara should be looking to take a step up, a serious step up against, you know, perhaps the winner of like Tavoris Cloud versus Adonis Stevenson. I mean, that would be a big step up, but I think that something like that would be a fairly logical next step or next step or two. Like, where do you think that he's capable of going next?
Well, I think that the promoters keep talking about, they want to put him in there with Bernard Hopkins at some point next year. And I believe this was like an IBF eliminator, which is Hopkins' belt. And I heard different reports that it was either like a semifinal or actually for the number one contender spot. I think Kovalev is ranked in there somewhere, so that he just won like whatever other belt. So he might get removed. So Funfara could become like the sanctioning body, you know, mandatory challenger for Hopkins. I don't know. I mean, I don't really like his chances in that fight. But I think it's another big event. You know, I mean, I think it'd be better for him to. The problem is he's beaten Campillo and he beat Glenn Johnson. He's got a couple finally, like, you know, respectable wins on his resume. He's so close to getting a big fight, a title shot, you know, something on a network above ESPN2. You know, do you take another fight with somebody kind of on his level to try to continue his development as a fighter, but potentially risk a bigger fight for him? Or do you just kind of throw him right in there and hope that, you know, Hopkins should take care of Murat and then maybe that opens up next year? Because he seemed, you know, like we were saying last week, I mean, I think Funfara would be a really desirable opponent for Hopkins in terms of the mixture.
Especially,
you know.
Well, and also, you know, I mean, the Philly isn't super close to Chicago, but it's close enough that, you know, if some fans from Philly wanted to come out and see Bernard Hopkins, you know, that could be something. But regardless,
I think Hopkins will have some fans here too. I mean, he'd be by far the biggest name fighter to fight here in years. Since what,
well,
like Eric Morales? And
then
Hopkins may be more famous than him. I mean, maybe not.
When put another, you know, put another handful of Polish fighters on the undercard, you know, and I think that you could probably draw 10 as opposed to 8. You know, and
I think so.
That's a good.
Yeah.
That's a really good turnout.
And another conversation
so
I was having, you know, real quick, you know, just being in the city and you know, leading up to this fight, I mean, I have to say, I think these guys did a great job and they pulled off the event and all that, but I really didn't hear a lot or see a lot as far as promotion for these fights last Friday. The Mayweather-Canelo press conference was just saturating all the airwaves, you know, it was on the radio, the newspapers, the news. I mean, you heard about it. People who weren't boxing fans just knew that was going on downtown that day. And so, you know, if Funfara fights Hopkins and it becomes like a Golden Boy co-promotion and you have their economic muscle and they can, you know, I think it's a much bigger event than Hopkins and Campillo. I mean, part of it that what was selling this was like, oh, it's the first event in a baseball stadium and it's outdoor and it's, you know, historic. I mean, there was a lot of like promotional hyperbole going into this, but you know, I still think it doesn't matter. You know, a Hopkins fight would be much bigger and I don't see why Bernard would be afraid of that. I mean, Funfara is like the perfect style for him to have another great performance.
Yeah,
and also,
I don't think that Hopkins would fear that style
No, I mean, I think Hopkins, I mean, I don't want to say this, but like, I think Hopkins might knock him out. And when's the last time Hopkins knocked somebody out?
He's fairly wide open. And he's shown that even before the Campillo fight. And so, I mean, I don't know that Hopkins would necessarily knock him out, but he would definitely, I would have to say, or at least I would bet on, that Hopkins would have his time with him.
Yeah, if he has anything left in the tank, I mean, if he fights like the way that he did against Cloud, I think it's just a complete demolition. And I don't see Fanfara knocking Hopkins out, but...
Well, let me say two things really quick. I forgot to say at the beginning of the show that Cliff Rold, writer for Boxing Scene and chair of the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board, is going to be joining us in maybe about a half hour or so. And I just wanted to point that out for anybody listening and wondering why he wasn't already with us. He will be soon. But also I wanted to say that I don't know if you got to hear much of it, but Nigel Collins actually did a really cool little segment on Friday Night Fights about the history of fighting in Chicago.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to kind of throw that out there because it was good. It was really good.
Yeah, it was great. It was a great segment.
Yeah. So anyway, just wanted to, throw that out there before I forgot.
And Grisham was in the house, just dominating the scene, as you would expect.
Yeah, Todd Grisham was basically kicking ass and taking all sorts of names. It's true.
Yeah, what was funny.
I was there.
Yeah, I went down to get a hot dog and I was walking past. I think it was before the ESPN coverage started, and just happened to walk right past where Grisham's like setup was, and he was just sitting there talking to these like two hot chicks who were kind of had that goofy
vibe.
No, that's
just classic Grisham.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the guy's a legend.
Yeah.
We had him so wrong.
The Ron Burgundy of Chicago.
Yeah, exactly.
James Bagg Jr. just asked us about our thoughts on Paul Malignaggi making YouTube videos while swimming with Phil LaGreco in Italy last year. So we got to give our thoughts.
Oh, man. I don't know. You know, I have some thoughts about Bagg's latest photo series of David Hay. I don't know if anyone's had a chance to catch that, but interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting
artistic
choice. Yeah.
Basically, you should, if you don't know who James Bagg Jr. is on Twitter, you should just go to his profile and look through his pictures because that alone is hilarity. But yeah, I had to give a shout out to that guy. Paul Malignaggi and Phil LaGreco swimming in Italy, that about stands alone. That speaks for itself.
I was a fan of it. You know, it ranked somewhere between the Victor Ortiz's Face Lube commercial and Adrian Broner's Popeyes video.
I was a big fan of Victor Ortiz's picture with the cowboy-looking guy, and he had the pink scarf around his neck. I was a big fan of that picture.
That was amazing.
Yeah, nearly amazing.
What's the odds on
him
getting an Oscar nomination for The Expendables 2?
Oh, I'd have to say he's the odds-on favorite already.
The
Screen Actors Guild has been chasing him for years.
Yeah, they're going to have a tough time deciding whether he should be in the Best Actor category or Best Supporting Actor.
Why
I have a feeling it's
going to
be one of those.
Same time.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those roles where it's probably not on screen a lot, but it's a major part of the story, and you could kind of argue either way.
Yeah, I just don't understand why he can't win both. But whatever. If you're going to take the guy's dreams away, that's fine. But speaking of dreams. A dream came true on Saturday when Darren Barker won a world title against Daniel Deal. And I don't know, do you call this the fight of the weekend? I mean, I don't even know what the fight of the weekend was at this point. I still have to think about that.
I don't
but,
know.
There's interesting
dynamics with that whole concept, the fight of the weekend. Because
well, usually it's easy. Usually there's one fight of the weekend.
Yeah, like I thought Granados and Salser was probably the best just pure fight. It wasn't as big of an event as Barker and Gill, though at the same time the attendance on Friday was probably, what I read, was like 7 or 8 times as many people as were in Atlantic City. But obviously being for a middleweight belt, it was a bigger fight than that. It was a great fight. I mean, it was really surprising to me. there was a lot of twists and turns, and you know, it was good for Barker. I thought he clearly won the fight. I didn't think it was that close, but I wasn't like, I didn't rewatch it five times with the sound off. I wasn't scoring it like round by round. But as I was watching it, you know, keeping just a loose tally in my head, I thought Barker, you know, definitely deserved the nod there. But, you know, what can you say, man? I mean, those guys just really slugged it out. Barker, you know, is pretty surprising that he was able to come back from that body shot and hurt him, and at the end of that round, hurt Gil at the end of that round. It was just, you know, really unexpected, and a great kind of cap on the weekend.
You know, I took a new approach, and what I did was I turned the video off and just listened to the HBO commentary. I scored it something like 11-1 Gil.
Nice.
But that was just the – I wanted to try it. You know, you got to try everything once. Now, I thought that it was something along the lines of like a 7-5 or 8-4, you know, barely win for Barker. Although, I mean, I felt like watching it, I felt like he won clearly. But if scoring it round by round, you know, it gets close because a lot of those rounds were close. And so if anybody had Gil winning, I – especially if it was fairly close, I didn't really have an issue with it. You know, it was a close fight. It was a tough, hard-fought fight.
It was. And I thought Gil was articulate in explaining his position. He thought that he won the fight. You know, it was two real gentlemen here.
Yeah, it's nice to, you know, like neither guy was talking about the other's side piece. You know, there was no shoving. Nobody got hit with like a you know, walkie-talkie or anything like that. As fun as those things are to see sometimes, it's nice to just see two guys who, you know, beat the shit out of each other just say, you know, it was a good fight, it was a close fight. And
Brock Newman
hell yeah.
climb on the ring and put somebody in a headlock and let the other guy kick him.
Yeah, Riddick Bowe, Elijah Tillery style.
That was good.
It was good stuff.
How about Eddie Cotton getting the fighters confused after the low blow? That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that was fairly amazing. I haven't really heard anything from Eddie Cotton about that one. But seriously, that's the type of thing that, even though it was fairly innocuous because nothing really happened, you know, like nobody was really hurt or anything, that's just the type of thing where, like, you know, a commission needs to pull a guy aside and say, look, dude, like, are you going to keep pulling this? Because if you are, then you're going to be out. Like that, that's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been. There's a lot of ways that could have gone wrong. I mean, what if he had penalized Barker, you know, in the next round or two, given him a point deduction, based on him thinking that had been him in the previous round? So.
Yeah, and I mean,
I guess it ultimately didn't matter.
Yeah,
what
I mean,
funny though,
I get
the next,
it. And it's tough.
Yeah, I thought that was funny in the next in the next round when Jones was commentating and he confused him. I mean, he just said their names wrong. He said, like, oh, great punch by Barker. And Kellerman was like, you mean Gil, you mean? And he was like, oh, yeah. He's like, my bad.
Yeah, it happens. And, like, especially when you're doing things on the fly and you're in the ring with the fighters, dude, it's a tough job and everything. And,
yeah,
but,
I mean,
you know,
Jones
Eddie,
was just like
Eddie
a verbal slip. But Eddie Cotton, I mean, I still just befuddled how that happened. I mean, you're standing in the ring with the two guys. The one guy's like keeled over still.
Yeah, one guy is clearly like, ow, that hurt. And then, you know, the other one is basically standing over there kind of like, you know, giving the contrite like, ah, sorry about that. And then
yeah, exactly.
Says, don't do it again.
Take as much time as you need.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Eddie Cotton's never been particularly great referee, although I will say that he made up for it a little bit, like later on in the fight when you could clearly see that he had the wife beater sweat stains in his shirt.
Uh-huh.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
The other thing about, you know, so cool. what do you make of these guys going forward? Are they going to be embroiled now? Barker will fight Sturm, and then Gil will go back to Australia, and then they fight a rematch. Or, you know, do we want to see these guys get in there with the guys we consider the top fighters at middleweight, like Golovkin?
Well, I mean, we were talking about this last week, and I think we had both picked Gil to win. I know I had. I think
no. We had Barker winning a close decision.
Oh yeah, that's right. No, that's right. But when we were basically looking at Barker's biggest test against Martinez, you know, we had both basically agreed that his effort against Martinez, while valiant, had been kind of overblown a little bit, and that, you know, just because a guy is giving someone problems doesn't necessarily mean that he himself is, you know, world-class, if the other guy's world-class. But I think that both guys showed that, number one, they should get some type of television, you know, appearance once more, because it was a great effort and great fight from both guys. But number two, you know, I think that they also both made no bad account of themselves for that. I think that looking at, after that fight, looking at both guys, they both look to me like they deserve a kind of next level type of fight. You know, Gil weathered a couple storms where he looked either hurt or wobbled, threw a ton of punches. Barker also got up from a really gnarly knockdown that, I mean, if you looked at that side view and the slow-mo, you could see his friggin' rib cage on one side of his body, and then during the punch, like, totally on the other side of his body. It was really nasty, but he got up from it.
We should give Cotton credit for that.
Those are the types of things that...
We should give Cotton credit for not stopping it, because he, you know, he got up at 9.
Yeah, now and especially because the HBO crew was like, oh, they're going to stop it, it's over. But no, he fought through it, and not only fought through it, but, you know, might have edged out just making it not a 10-8 round from that point, because he fought his ass off in the last 30 seconds. So, yeah, it was just the type of effort from both guys where I think that they both deserve more, or, you know, better money for a rematch or something.
Mm-hmm. Barker really impressed me. You know, because I think he improved a lot since he fought Martinez, but it also speaks to, you know, how good Sergio was, and even as an older guy, I mean, with his speed at middleweight, and, you know, the fact that he could just toy with guys like Barker and Macklin, you know, he was really an elite level fighter, and probably, I mean, clearly above these guys' level. And, you know, Golovkin has the look that he's probably more on that level too, but I'd like to see,
well,
you know, eventually
a couple shows ago, and, you know, you had in particular had pointed it out, probably because you were there for the Martinez Chavez fight, but mm-hmm. you know, and maybe you were really right, but you had basically said maybe that fight really did take a lot out of Sergio Martinez's legs, you know, that in the combination of, you know, fights before that, because since then
it looks like it.
He certainly, yeah, that's what it looks like since then. So, you know, I think that if you give Darren Barker another shot at Sergio Martinez, for example, I mean, he might make better use of that shot if that were the case at this point.
I don't know. I mean,
you know,
it's going to be interesting. You know, I mean, I think with Sergio. We're really only basing this on the Martin Murray fight. And that was a weird night. And it was his first homecoming in Argentina. You have 40,000 people there in a soccer stadium. And it was, you know, remember it was like horrible weather and raining, and they had to move the main event up 2 hours or something like that. And there could have been effects with like the wind and the canvas might have been, I mean, we don't know. I mean, like, there was a lot of stuff going on, and Martinez still survived the 12 rounds and arguably won that fight. So maybe we've, you know, I don't know. I mean, as time's gone, right after that fight, I was kind of like, yeah, Martinez is done. Like, I don't even want to see him fight Golovkin. I think that his legs are gone. I don't think he's the same athlete. I think with his style, he's going to have problems defending himself, and he's going to get, you know, hurt if he fights another top-level, big-size middleweight. But, we won't, you know, we can't say for sure until we actually see him come back next year. I mean, at his age, the prospect doesn't look great, but...
Well, I think that the biggest thing right now is that, you know, maybe 2 years ago or so, you look at the middleweight division, and you would basically say, well, Sergio Martinez has it on lockdown. You know, he's the champion, and most people didn't really see anyone, you know, in the immediate future beating him or coming all that close to beating him. And I think now, you know, granted, 2 years can do a lot, but still, just looking at the middleweight division now, it looks more wide open. it looks like there are a couple guys who could step forward and take the reins if given the opportunity. So I think that that alone is fairly interesting, and it kind of says a lot about, you know, where Sergio Martinez may be.
Yeah, I think it's a really it's become a really interesting division, and you're going to get guys, if Sturm will fight Barker and you know, if Gil eventually rematches Barker. I mean, there's a lot of things going on, you know, and Martinez is kind of a wild card. I mean, he's Chavez, I don't know if Chavez is even going to fight as a middleweight anymore, but other than Chavez, you know, Martinez is probably still brings the most money and is the biggest name, and, you know, he's going to be able to kind of control his own destiny. Maybe he can get a fight with Miguel Cotto, something that they talked about. Maybe he really does want to make the Golovkin fight, but it will definitely be interesting to see how this all plays out. And then Peter Quillen, I think, is a really, looks like a really talented fighter with a big punch, and, you know, maybe somewhere down the road, Quillen and Golovkin becomes a big matchup.
Yeah, I think Peter Quillen is kind of the wild card in the division where, he's for a while wasn't really thought very highly of, and then he's had a couple performances that, you know, have turned heads, and even though he's not really that much in the discussion for the most part, at least not that I can see.
Why, because of the politics?
And I was going to say possibly because he's, you know, with Golden Boy, but, you know, I think that, yeah, he's the type of guy that if you put him in with a lot of those guys, he could really give them issues. But hopefully we get to find out. I don't know.
Yeah, now do you think Sergio can possibly, let's say that he just comes back for one huge fight with Golovkin, like, next summer. Do you think he could summon it up for 36 minutes to put on one great performance and be competitive?
That's tough because what kind of worries me about Sergio Martinez is that I know he's had knee issues, and that, you know, I think that he either had to get surgery or some major procedure done on one of his knees. And so for his style, that could wind up being, you know, long-term an issue. But I think the combination of Golovkin obviously being good, but probably getting a little overrated in general, even though I really like the guy, the combination of Golovkin being a little bit overrated and Martinez probably getting underrated now might lead for a more competitive fight than a lot of people think.
Yeah, I'm warming up to it. I hated it after the Martinez fight and seeing what Golovkin did to Macklin, but, you know, there's just something special about guys like Martinez, and I think that it's not unreasonable to kind of have hope that maybe he could summon up one last great performance and somehow turn that into a really exciting fight and maybe win it. But I would still heavily favor Golovkin, but I'm not as opposed to seeing it. And what's funny is, like, I was also kind of more intrigued by Martinez Cotto a month ago, and now my opinion on that has changed a little bit, where I still think that Martinez might be too much for him, and that could turn into kind of a, you know, one-sided type of beating for Miguel.
Yeah, Miguel Cotto for me is like, I feel like I'm not the most biased person because I am a fan. I do feel like he could be more competitive than he has been, and that he's faced a couple of kind of crappy styles lately.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tough for me to totally, yeah.
But what would you think of Prime Martinez against like 2 years ago, the Cotto who had beaten Margarito against, you know, rematched Margarito versus the Martinez who, you know, was knocking out Barker and Macklin and.
Well, I think that if it's like a more realistic 154, like if you make that fight at 154 and it's kind of like a, you know, the Martinez who faced like Kermit Cintron or something like that, you know, I think that Cotto's pretty competitive in that fight. But, you know,
I don't know.
At 160, I just don't know. I don't know that Miguel Cotto can really hang at that weight. I think that 154 is kind of pushing it for him because he's really not a big guy at all.
Yeah, I would have always kind of thought that Martinez's speed would be too much for him, because I don't think Cotto was ever really particularly fast, and I think he's slowed down even from what he was.
I do think he's gotten smarter as a fighter, though.
Yeah, I think he's a really good boxer.
And I think that's where I would give him, you know, but that's where I would give him the chance. But yeah, I mean, I don't know that I would favor him in that fight. Yeah.
Well, I think that's probably what we're going to end up looking at. You know, I don't know if Martinez wants to go back in there with Chavez, especially since I don't think Chavez can make 160 anymore. And, you know, there's going to be a big push from HBO to try to make Martinez-Golovkin, but Martinez-Cotto obviously would be a pretty huge event too. So, you know, that's, in my mind, that's probably what we're going to end up seeing from Sergio.
Well, hey, before Cliff jumps on with us, I wanted to try to, like, wrap up last weekend.
Yeah,
I also wanted to ask you about – no, it's all good. I wanted to ask you about what you thought about Kovalev, Sergey Kovalev's win over Nathan Cleverley. And, I mean, we did talk about it last week, so –
what can you possibly think about it? I mean, yeah, I'm totally on board with Kovalev.
Well, I didn't know that it would be quite like that. I mean, I thought that –
I didn't either.
Well,
I picked Cleverley to win on points. Terrible.
Well, and I mean, first off, I'd like to give a little bit of credit to Roy Jones because, you know, I've kind of badmouthed his commentating a couple times in the past just because he says crazy shit sometimes. But he basically called it from the first round on, and he was like, I don't know why Nathan Cleverley is sitting here trying to pound it out with, you know, Sergey Kovalev because he's getting caught and he's not going to be able to stand up to the power. And that's exactly what wound up happening because I didn't see Nathan Cleverley doing that either. I thought that he was going to be using his legs, throwing a lot of punches and, like, using angles because that's just kind of, like, the type of fighter that I'd seen before. And,
yeah,
you know, I guess credit to him for trying to, you know, make a fight out of it. But, damn, he got completely squished.
Well, I think Kovalev showed he's just on another level than Cleverley. And Cleverley's not a bad fighter. He's not what they necessarily, you know, marketed him as, but he's still, you know, competent contender at light heavyweight and a guy who can box and move and has decent hand speed and activity, and he just had nothing to offer against Kovalev. And now this is the second time in a row. You know, when he knocked out Campillo, I mean, there's some doubters. We didn't know exactly what Campillo's condition was going into the fight. He's older and, you know, maybe he didn't really have a chance to warm up, but I mean, now this is twice in a row. He's just knocked out, blown away, destroyed guys who are incredible top 10 contenders at light heavyweight. So, you know, I'd love to see this guy fight again, and I think it's a really interesting addition. You know, all of a sudden the light heavyweight division has its own Golovkin type of fighter. And
and we were even talking about that last week too, with like the comparisons to Golovkin, and like I just said that don't really undersell him in the skill department because he looks like a bruising caveman type of guy, but he's not. You know, he measures with his shots, and you know, Max Kellerman was calling it too, even though he gets a little bit too enthusiastic with it, but he was calling it correctly, where, you know, Kovalev was darting forward, but then when Cleverley was trying to counter, he was kind of just, you know, moving his head just right, you know, avoiding the incoming. He's not a completely unskilled guy like Golovkin.
I think they're different
the
kinds of
fighters. The punching power gets a lot of that overlooked.
Yeah, I mean, Golovkin's more, I think, methodical than Kovalev. But, you know, a guy who can punch like that, who's throwing as many punches as he is, and seems to have some nuance and ability to, you know, defend himself and look at, you know, a little bit of boxing skill, I mean, he's going to be a dangerous fighter for anybody in that division. And again, it's another thing for fans to be excited about because you have another monster puncher who's technically the lineal champion, Adonis Stevenson. I mean, I would favorite Kovalev in that fight. But you have a lot of other interesting things happening. You know, you got Andre Ward in the middle there at 168, a real kind of pound-for-pound level talent. And, you know, in the next couple of years are shaping up to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough for me to – I mean, dude, I'm a hater. Everybody knows it. I'm like the resident hater, and I talk shit, and that's just kind of what I do because I think it's funny, but I don't really have anything to say badly about how boxing is going in 2013. I'm still not happy with you know, HBO and Showtime and Top Rank and Golden Boy, but with what we've been getting, it's almost, I don't want to say I don't care, but if we're going to be getting fights like this, then I don't care. it's nice.
I'm with you. I mean, right now there's not really any kind of mandate. You know, a fight like Quillen and Golovkin, that's one of the fights where it's like, oh, that sucks that that can't happen. But there's still other things that can happen before that that would make that fight even bigger, you know. And
yeah, for both guys. I mean,
there's not a whole lot of fights that come to mind immediately that you're thinking, you know, it sucks that the top-ranked Golden Boy feud, we can't get those.
Yeah, there aren't very many fights right off the bat where I'm thinking, you know, it's a friggin' travesty that we haven't gotten this fight. And I mean, I'm not even going to go down the Floyd Mayweather Manny Pacquiao road. That's some other type of shit that's going to go take us on a tangent I don't want to go on. But the only fight that I can think of in the last year or so where I thought, well, damn, was Nonito Donaire versus Abner Mattes, which is at this point not even really an issue. And, you know, if they're not going to put Guillermo Rigondeaux on TV, and they're not really seeming like they're going to, at least not in the foreseeable future, then Abner Mattes versus him isn't really an issue either, as much as that sucks.
That's what's interesting is that was one of the big ones where, you know, the Meraz-Donaire fight, but yet there's not the same feeling that a Rigondeaux-Meraz fight has to happen.
I'd like to see it happen, but yeah, it's not the same type of like demand, needless to say.
Yeah, see, those divisions right now are shaping up kind of like Mikey Garcia is going to 30, and Meraz Garcia would be a great fight, but that's not going to happen because of the promotional feud, and Rigondeaux is still at 122, and who knows what Donaire is going to do. He's going to bounce somewhere in the middle there. Those are some divisions where the big fights that could potentially happen don't look like they're really on the immediate horizon. But, you know, with middleweight and light heavyweight and that whole area, there's a lot of stuff shaping up to be really good.
Yeah. For sure. And there's
because even if
a
fighter moves up in weight, there's another guy waiting for him. Yeah. And, I mean, I do want to see Andre Ward get back and fight again and be somebody who could potentially be a huge opponent for guys like Golovkin if he comes up, or Kovalev if Ward goes up.
Well, we were just talking about, like, you know, 122 in featherweight, and kind of branching off that, I wanted to ask you real quick about the kind of sandwich fight, what I like to call the sandwich fights, which are like the in-betweener fights on cards, especially with triple headers, and which was Kiko Martinez, TKO, over Jonathan Romero.
Yeah.
Do you think that fight went on a little bit too long?
I didn't really, you know, I guess later I found out, you know, or maybe reading what other people were saying, that Romero was a lot more hurt than I thought that he was. I gotta be honest. I mean, when it actually unfolded, I thought the stoppage was like a tad quick, if anything. I think that like a minute earlier, now I'm not saying it was a bad stoppage, because I think Romero was like badly beaten up and probably shouldn't have been allowed to continue. But I'm just saying my like immediate instinct, just because he had caught Martinez with a couple big counter punches in the exchange right before that, and Martinez, I don't know. But, no, I think, you know, with some time to think about it, I mean, I think it was an appropriate stoppage, and, man, it was a hell of a win for Martinez. I didn't know a whole lot about Romero coming into it, but I thought he would be the favorite, and he was definitely had the, you know, superior kind of boxing pedigree, and Martinez just walked him down and hurt him badly, and, you know, it's a big win. And I guess now he's got a belt.
And Romero actually had another advantage going into the fight, his eyebrow ring.
It's always, yeah.
They've been known to harness chi, if you will.
And he grew up in the most dangerous neighborhood in the Western Hemisphere, per Lampley.
Well, that'll do it. You know, if Larry Merchant were on hand there, he would have said something about a rice patty and a lotus flower. And, you know, it would have been
tough
beautiful.
Tough as weeds.
Yeah, but it would have been beautiful, but he wasn't there. But yeah, it was. That was actually a solid fight, although I thought that Jonathan Romero kind of got beaten up. I just didn't like the very last sequence where the referee was literally about 18 inches from the action, and it looked to me like Romero probably took two or three more right hands than he really needed to, and was kind of fading and sinking down a little bit before the ref even stepped in. I mean, is it the worst stoppage I've ever seen? No, it's definitely not, but I thought it could have been stopped a little bit earlier. But yeah, that was about all.
Yeah, I was watching it with a British friend who just moved to Chicago, and he was commenting on kind of how like the American broadcasts have this much more of like an American Idol feel to them in the way that they broadcast the fighter. You know, they show the backstories, and everyone has some like, you know, heartbreaking thing to kind of like compel the viewers. It was kind of interesting. Once you pointed that out, you noticed that those promos do tend to be a little, you know, sappy.
Well, I think that, I mean, if you look at shows like The Contender and, you know, those type of shows where they tried to, you know, make reality TV out of boxing, or at least, you know, I think the end game was making boxing more compelling or more sellable. I think that a lot of programmers and, you know, producers think that that's what people want. You know, all of the popular fighters who were on The Contender, and I mean, well, not all of them, but a couple of the fighters who were on The Contender got more popular because their backstory was sold the way it was. You know, I think it was Anthony Bonsante, who is, you know, kind of a journeyman type of guy, you know, actually got a little bit of play because of the, you know, world's greatest dad hat or shirt that he kept wearing. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, just that kind of like, you know, happy ending type of story, for whatever reason, they think it sells, and sometimes it does. But yeah, I think that there's just a little bit more local and regional support in the UK, especially with boxing, where it's probably just more of a way of life or something that's on TV and you kind of accept it, and you're not really worried about it being like a dying breed or anything like that. Like people are always saying here in the States, like boxing is dying or boxing is dead. I would have to think that that probably isn't really pondered as much in the UK as it is here.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe they don't feel the need to explain, like, you know, this is why.
See, this is why you need to watch, because these guys are people too. See, they have families. You know, it's there. I don't feel like there's as much of that. You know, it's kind of just you fight, and that's what it is. At least that's what it feels like to me. But yeah, but actually, speaking of Europe, they brought it up a couple times during the broadcast, that Kiko Martinez versus Jonathan Romero fight, that Martinez had come to befriend Sergio Martinez, and that Kiko Martinez was originally from Spain, which is going through a really tough economic time right now, like much of Europe. So I thought that that was also kind of just an interesting, you know, angle to the story, that kind of linking him to Sergio Martinez in a way, and also they share trainers, of course. But yeah, I mean, there haven't really been a whole ton of Spanish, you know, even just fairly minor world titleists, and not even so much champions. So I thought that that was kind of interesting in itself, and it wasn't really. Even just the Spanish part wasn't played up a lot during the broadcast. So, yeah, it was a nice win for the guy, and he seemed genuinely elated about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely more satisfying viewing experience than had Romero just kind of easily outboxed him, you know, win a decision, which was probably kind of the stock prediction going into it.
Yeah, I think that it probably was. I think that if nothing else, just not quite as much was known about Kiko Martinez. But, you know, I have no idea what Jonathan Romero was thinking, just basically sitting on the ropes in that first round, because that was like the worst decision he could have made. And it was, because he friggin' got hurt very badly in the first round and didn't really look like he, you know, 1,000% recovered after that, even though he had a good, I think, second and third round. But, yeah, I thought that Kiko Martinez was not going to be able to basically step in and do what he did. So I gotta give him credit for doing that, for sure. But actually, I was going to ask you also, did you wind up catching the Danny Jacobs fight last night on Fox Sports?
I did, yeah. I mean, I saw the knockout.
I completely forgot that it was even on, period. Like,
I don't have
card
Fox Sports for one thing. So I had Boxing Guru up on the computer and was checking it out, and I kind of like got distracted right when the fight started, but turned it on just in time to see the ending.
Dude, don't blow up the spot.
Yep, sorry.
kidding.
Yeah. Well, I think you got to be impressed with that.
Yeah, and I was actually
top guy's never been stopped.
And I was saying last night before I went to bed that, you know, it might sound really bad, and I don't mean it to sound bad or disrespectful, or I'm not even trying to make a joke, but I just wasn't all that big of a fan of Danny Jacobs before his cancer scare. Well, it was more of a scare. It was a fight with cancer. And since then, for whatever reason, and we were just talking about this kind of like sappy, compelling story, but for whatever reason, it's worked with me. Because now I would like to see the guy do well. I want to see him succeed, and now he's maybe it's that's kind of making a bias for me. But he does seem like he has improved as a fighter. Maybe he's just more focused. I don't know. But whatever it is, it was a big stoppage, and he basically bashed the crap out of Giovanni Lorenzo, who is, like you said, taking on a handful of top guys himself, and never had that done to him before. So, yeah, it was nice. I just wish I would have remembered the entire card rather than just the main event. I turned it on literally just in time for the main event because I completely forgot that it was even going to be on. But a couple people had remarked last night that, you know, this is just kind of another example of there being more boxing on television, which I am just all for. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, of course I'm going to root. You know, who wouldn't root for Danny Jacobs? I mean, this is a great backstory, and he seems like a really nice guy.
Yeah, he seems like a genuinely good kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not really into the religious aspect of just about anything, but I'm not going to, you know, hate on somebody because they are. So, you know, I like his story, and, yeah, if anybody's rooting against him, I have to question whether or not they have a soul.
Yeah,
but
I was
just going to say that Cliff Rold should be joining us soon. But in the meantime, I mean, we still have stuff to talk about. I mean, there's big boxing weekend coming up this weekend. Well, not quite as big in terms of quantity, but in terms of a fight that, in my eyes, should, you know, stand up to be something significant in Abdermatis versus Johnny Gonzalez, who is, as everybody knows, my dude. But I like both fighters, so I think that it's probably going to be fireworks as long as it lasts. And then, of course, Leo Santa Cruz versus Vico Terrazas. So what do you got this card pegged as?
I think it's a good card. I think that Terrazas is a good step up for Santa Cruz. Terrazas fought Mijares earlier this year, and I actually thought Mijares maybe nicked it, but it was a really close fight, and I think it's. I think that could actually be a really good fight. As far as the main event, you know, like we've said before, I mean, Gonzalez is a big puncher, and he's been in, he's had experience. I think it's a similar kind of level of fight to Ponce de Leon, who Meraz just fought. And I guess ultimately, you know, I think Meraz is going to figure out a way to get the win. But there's going to be some intrigue, and I think it's a good card. You know, it's kicking off this stretch of a lot of really good fights coming up.
Yeah, it kind of, I'm not going to lie, you know, as a Johnny Gonzalez fan, you know, I have told the brief anecdote before, but he was on the very first card that I had covered, and he was, you know, only a couple guys really even wanted to, like, take pictures or stop and talk or anything like that, and he was one of the few guys who did. And so, you know, I guess I just kind of, for whatever reason, followed his career, liked him, et cetera. But, you know, he has wound up being in a number of fun fights, good fights, even in losses. But even as a fan, I do have to kind of worry about him a little bit in this fight. He's never had the greatest chin in the world. And when he gets hurt, his legs seem to go fairly quickly against a guy who's really bruising, like, just kind of a bruising, grinding fighter like Abnett Mares, it could wind up being bad. I don't know, but at the end of the day, Gonzalez still does have his punching power, and that, you know, that's enough to, I think, you know, give it a second look for sure. So I'm looking forward to it, you know, I'm looking forward to the card in general, but I'd love to see one last hurrah.
How do you see the undercard going?
I like Leo Santa Cruz too. He's another guy that I've become a fan of, you know, in the past few years. I don't really see how anybody is not a fan of his. He throws a ton of punches. He goes to the body like nobody's business. And, you know, he's basically just all fight. He doesn't really have much let up. And, I mean, who doesn't like a fighter like that? I don't know who, you know. Probably like Osama bin Laden or Adolf Hitler. They probably don't like fighters like that. But, I mean, you know, I have also seen a bit of Victor Terrazas, and he's a decent fighter. But he, from what I've seen, is kind of a guy who, like, takes time off and fights, you know, in spurts sometimes. And I don't think that that's a good idea against Leo Santa Cruz if that's what you're used to. So I see that Abner Mattis should probably take the main event, and Leo Santa Cruz should win big on the undercard as well. So in that respect, I think that a lot of people have pointed out that they think that it's more of a showcase type of card than anything, that it's kind of being, you know, overhyped. But there's possibilities there.
Yeah, and Golden Boy's had a weird way this year of kind of having these things turn into more than just showcases when they look like it.
Well, and a lot of people were kind of, you know, not really looking that forward to the Maidana Josecito Lopez card too. I mean, it was anticipated, but some people
really?
Were like, yeah, there wasn't. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm not saying that nobody cared. There were a lot of people. I looked forward to it. I was like, this is going to be a good card. But, you know, there were just a couple folks in the media that were kind
See,
of
I was thinking
to
of
not really think it was that much.
I was kind of thinking of like Garcia Judah and Broner Malignaggi and then Berto Soto Carrasco,
yeah.
You know, and it's like all of those turned
those
into
too.
Being really competitive, fun, kind of fun fights.
No, they've had a good year, a good stretch this last couple months too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Terrazas to me seems like a, you know, you could consider him kind of a step up for Santa Cruz.
Yeah, I would say that he's probably a step up because Santa Cruz is like, he seems to be pursuing the bigger names overall. Like, he's been calling out Abner Mattis since, gosh, what was it? It was after Mattis, what's his name? Oh, man, the fight that was scored so horribly. But I was at it. I can't even remember his name. Anselmo Moreno.
Okay.
After that fight, Leo Santa
Cruz
was calling out.
You thought that was scored horribly?
Well, there was one card that didn't give Moreno a round.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was
bad.
I meant like that.
I didn't remember that.
No, Mattis clearly won, although I thought he had much more trouble than that.
There was one really wide, like it was 10-2 in rounds or something.
Yeah, it was. There was just a yeah. Yeah, that's what I meant. I didn't think that Moreno should have won.
I couldn't remember if that was.
Yeah,
because some people did have think Moreno won that fight.
Yeah, I thought that it was closer than that. I thought it, you know, one judge, I think, literally scored at something like 120, 106 or something like that because of the knockdowns. And I was like, I didn't see that fight at all. But,
kind of
you know,
sure.
Whatever, Mattis surely won. But after that fight at the press conference, Leo Santa Cruz was saying, well, I think it's time now for me to step up and take on Abner Mattis. And Abner pretty much just, like, dismissed that. He was kind of like, it's a little too soon for you. We're not really looking at that right now. But I think that was also at the point where they were really looking towards doing a Donaire fight. And so that was on their radar. I think that Leo Santa Cruz, if he wins this fight, should be more, you know, in a position to take on an Abner Mattis type of guy. But I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of torn because I think that he's come a long way and he's an exciting fighter. And so because he's exciting, he deserves, you know, bigger spots should he keep winning. But at the same time, with his style, he's probably not going to last super long. And so I'd kind of like to see him, you know, strike while the iron's hot if he should, you know.
Sure.
I don't know. It's tough with a guy like that, I think. He's got a lot of potential, but he's young still. He's still, like, I think 22. So he's still got a lot of time.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really impressed with Mahrez, too, the last few years. You know, I mean, he's just really been taking one tough fight after another and keeps on winning.
Yeah, his schedule is, like, you know, maybe second to Carl Froch in the sport, maybe.
Yep.
I don't know. I don't even know how you would necessarily measure it, but he's had a hell of a schedule. That said, our buddy Cliff Rold is on the line here. Let me patch him through. Mr. Rold.
Mr. Connor, how are you?
I'm doing great, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we hear you great.
Great.
Buddy James.
Perfect.
James Foley on the line here.
How's it going, Cliff?
How you doing, James? Good talking
good.
To you. So I overheard that last part there. I don't know if Mahrez's schedule is second to anyone. He's right there with Carl Froch. And unlike Froch, he proved he could handle one of the slickest boxers on earth when he beat Moreno. So, you know, Mahrez is up there with anybody in the last 10 years as far as strength of schedule goes.
I knew you were going to have something
to say about that.
Anytime I can mention Moreno, I'm going to say something.
Did you think that Mahrez won that fight pretty clearly?
I thought it was very close. I may have actually scored it for Moreno, but I have a style preference there. You know, I understand, you know, it was a closer fight than the scores. I didn't have a problem, though, with two of the three official scores, the 116-110. It was the kind of fight where there were a lot of rounds that you could see one way or the other. The shutout score was an abomination, but, you know, it's boxing. You're always going to have some of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, ain't that the truth? So, I mean, I was basically saying exactly what you were saying, was that the shutout score was pretty crappy, and that I thought that there were a couple of pretty clear rounds that Moreno should have won. But, I mean, as far as the larger discussion, you know, should both fighters win this Saturday, do you think that Leo Santa Cruz is in any position to take on an Abner Mahdes? Like, do you think that he's ready for that?
I mean, look, nobody's really ready until they get the fight. So, you know, you can't really be sure until you see them in with that level of competition. I mean, you go back a couple of years, with Abner Mahrez ready for Yanni Perez and Victor Kenyon and Joseph Agbeko. I mean, we watched him mature as a fighter to the point where, you know, each time we saw him, he got a little better. Until he gets to Ponce de Leon and decisively walks through a guy that has given a lot of other good fighters struggles. I mean, only one other guy has ever just walked through Ponce de Leon, and that was a guy who got him in the first round, which can sometimes be very deceiving. So, you know, I think Santa Cruz will be – this is a maturation fight. He's fighting Victor Terrazas. That's a good veteran. He could just as easily be fighting Christian Mahrez right now. I thought Mahrez earned the decision against Terrazas. He didn't get it. So, but Terrazas is a rugged guy. You know, he managed to get by Montiel. He managed to get by Mahrez. He's going to be a test. And at the end of this fight, Santa Cruz will be 12 rounds more prepared for whatever comes next if he wins. And I think that's all you can really ask of him, is to grow in his preparation. I think we'll know more. But I don't think they're going to go straight to Mahrez anyways. I don't think he's ready to go to 126. I think that's a fight that we're looking at, you know, 8 to 12 months from now. And I think a year from now we could feel very different about where he is in terms of his development.
Well, right before you probably called in, I was obviously talking about my affinity for Johnny Gonzalez that I've had over the years. But in terms of that fight itself.
You have a Johnny man crush for sure.
Yeah, a little bit, just a little bit. I mean, it's born of a good place, but yeah,
I will say that I am biased. It's not as bad as me on flyweights, Pat, so we're okay.
That is true. And we'll get to that, I'm sure. I do have a flyweight question to ask you. But this weekend, though, do you think that Johnny Gonzalez has any type of reasonable shot?
Sure. when is Johnny Gonzalez ever out of a fight? I mean, you know, he one of the things that makes him one of the more exciting fighters of recent memory is that he can pretty much fight anybody tooth and nail. And he's got a shot to win. He's got a shot to lose. And when you look at his quality of opposition, I mean, he's fought a lot of guys. You know, Israel Vasquez had him on the brink, couldn't finish. Hozumi Hasegawa, you know, he's getting outboxed. He finishes him off. You know, the last fight with Ponce de Leon, we saw an odd sort of counterpuncher's duel come out. So not a lot of excitement there, but Morris is going to come to fight, and he's going to get inside. I'm curious this weekend to see if point deductions could play in, because I'm not sold that Morris is a, you know, is we're going to keep seeing knockouts from him, although Gonzalez can be knocked out. But I do wonder if we could get ourselves into a situation where, you know, because of Gonzalez's height, Morris's propensity to throw low blows could become a factor in the fight. Could he lose points? Could he tighten the card? This could be a very interesting fight, scoring-wise.
Well, I think that we've seen, in general, that a lot of referees, for whatever reason, seem really reluctant to jump on Abner Mares. And, I mean, whether or not you think that he is a quote-unquote dirty fighter, you know, it obviously varies, you know, from person to person. But either way, I think that we've seen referees, they just don't really seem very very apt to take points away from him when some crazy shit goes down. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know if I'd call him dirty. I think you might call him classically rough. You know, there were other fighters like that in history where, you know, their aggression was so sort of sustained that it was hard to interrupt the flow of the action to take deduction. You know, and they knew how to foul and do it quickly. Now, in Morris's case, there have been some, you know, incidents that stand out that are sort of absurd, right? Like Russell Mora looking at him, throwing ball shots and not saying anything. But you look at a guy like Roberto Duran or a guy like Mike Tyson, they were hard to call fouls on in their prime because right after the foul was the shot. And, you know, it's hard to break the flow of the action. So I don't think they're overlooking it with Morris. It's just hard to jump in and stop the fight.
Well, it's just kind of an odd situation because I think that a lot of it is him being, like, ultra-aggressive and almost kind of, like, losing control of, you know, like, losing precision with the more punches that he throws and the more aggression that he has. So I don't think that it's 100% intentional. Although at the same time,
it
does affect the fight, though. And so I think that that's the issue for me is that, like, you know, whether it's intentional or not, the other guy's feeling it.
Well, yeah, but I'm not saying it's unintentional. I'm saying it's hard to call. I actually don't think it's a lost precision. I think sometimes he just throws cup shots. And he does it in sort of an intelligent way. I mean, it's not quite as sort of, I guess, using the same word again, it's not quite as intelligent as maybe the way a Julio Cesar Chavez got away with it, you know, banging the hips, banging the front of the cup. But he doesn't make it easy. He doesn't make it easy to call it. But, again, I don't think it's lost precision. I don't think he loses control. I mean, he's not a guy like, you know, Terry Norris back in the day who seemed to just sort of lose himself and not realize what he was doing as he was blasting guys on the floor.
Yeah, he did that a bit too often for that to be, you know. I don't even want to count as many times.
Terry Norris got away with it against Sugar Ray Leonard but didn't get away with it against Luis Santana. This is a weird world we live in.
Yeah, twice. Yeah.
Twice.
Well,
so, yeah,
I know that James had some. Go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to say that we had, like, stuff lined up to ask you, and I was going to get through as much preview stuff as we could, but I know that James had some stuff to ask you as well.
All day, whatever you guys want.
All right. yeah, Cliff. So, obviously, the huge event coming up that's kind of overshadowing, you know, the rest of the boxing schedule is Mayweather against Canelo Alvarez.
Is that fight coming up?
I think so. it's what I read. So, you know, I wonder, like, it seems that there's kind of this perception that Mayweather's basically unbeatable. Do you think that, you know, maybe people get too caught up in the mythology of Mayweather and this idea that, you know, no one is on his class and no one can reasonably beat him, and, you know, what kind of chance do you personally give Saul Alvarez to break that trend?
I'm not sure about Alvarez in general. I mean, I don't think Floyd Mayweather is unbeatable. I don't think anybody's unbeatable. You know, Floyd's activity level for a few years helped him, maybe helped remain unbeaten for a while, although I don't know that there was anybody that was going to beat him, including Pacquiao. But, I mean, you know, I thought he lost the first Castillo fight. I mean, he got good fights from he got a good fight from Cotto last year. I mean, it wasn't that he was close to losing, but he got good fights from guys. So, you know, there have been guys historically who probably could have beaten him. There might not have been anybody in his era who could have beaten him, and that's all you can really say, but we haven't seen it so far, at least officially. Now, as far as Alvarez, my problem with Alvarez is he's not really sort of ultra-aggressive. He's a spot fighter. So you've got a pot-shotting counterpuncher like Floyd Mayweather who really doesn't throw in volume. I mean, he's not the version of himself he was, you know, from 130 to 140. He's a guy who picks his spots and sort of clubs guys versus a guy who in Canelo who also fights in spots, you know. One of the things I saw against Austin Trout, I underrated personally Canelo's head movement, sort of his boxing ability. But he's still, you know, he's still not incredibly difficult to hit. I thought the Austin Trout fight was, you know, I would have scored it differently than it was officially. I thought it was a much closer fight than some of the scores. And I just, in a fight between two counterpunchers, and we saw this in Floyd's fight with Mayweather or with Marquez and a few other people, in a fight between two counterpunchers, the guy who can make the other guy lead has the advantage. Well, nobody can make Floyd Mayweather do anything he doesn't want to do in a boxing ring. The closest anyone came was Castillo, and that was because Castillo put the sort of relentless pressure and was willing to sort of keep coming forward where you know, strategy and precision can be thrown out the window. But in the case of Alvarez, he's going to be looking to land bombs. I think in the first couple rounds, he's his most dangerous. If he can stun Floyd early and put a hurt on him and slow Floyd down at 36 years old, he will have a shot. But if this is like the Guerrero fight and other, even the Mosley fight, you know, where you know, Floyd gets through that first couple rounds and gets that timing down, he's going to force Alvarez to lead, and he's going to walk him into that right hand all night long.
Oh, that's
kind of the feeling that I get.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't buy into this. I think it's BS when people say things like, you know, oh, well, Floyd wouldn't have fought him if he didn't think he could win. I mean, you know, every fighters at Floyd's level think they can win every fight. That, you know, they don't take crazy fights. I mean, you know, he's not going up to light heavyweight or anything crazy like that, you know. But I mean, who he should fight that is, you know, who he doesn't think he could beat between, you know, 140 and 154 pounds, I don't think that fighter exists. He took the biggest, best fight out there. And one of the things Floyd doesn't get enough credit for is since he's come back from after the Marquez fight, you know, when he couldn't get Pacquiao, he fought the next best welterweight available each time, you know, as far as, you know, where you would rank fighters. And I know, you know, some people take that with a grain of salt, but as far as where the welterweight division sat when he took fights, you know, Ortiz off the Berto fight, Guerrero off two top 10 wins, he fought the right guys. Now he's back at junior middleweight, and he's fighting the right guy. So, you know, he deserves credit for that, and I think he'll deserve credit for the win because I don't see Canelo Alvarez beating Floyd Mayweather.
Well, it seems to be kind of split because we've asked a number of people. So some people seem to think that, I think the consensus seems to be that, yes, Canelo has a chance, but that the chance is fairly small.
Yeah,
but it seems to be kind of split as far as how it could happen.
If people think that Canelo Alvarez is going to outbox Floyd Mayweather fighting, you know, in 30-second spots over the course of 12 rounds, they might be able to steal a decision from Floyd Mayweather with Alvarez fighting that way, but I don't think that he could actually outright win the fight fighting that way. I mean, he's going to have to sustain his offense, or he's going to have to get Floyd to freeze and stand still while he takes shots at him. I mean, either one of those scenarios is tough to fathom.
But do you think, I mean, looking at Canelo compared to Guerrero and Ortiz and Floyd's recent opponents, even the older version of Mosley and the Marquez in that fight, is there an argument that Canelo brings a lot more than those guys did?
Oh, sure. I mean, he's bigger. He's young. You know, if he wants to come forward and he can take Floyd and he can take a sustained drumbeat of sort of Floyd Mayweather right hand, he can make things really uncomfortable just through sheer physical presence and strength. But at the end of the day, you know, he's still going to have to land more than Floyd. I mean, they're not just going to take Floyd's O off of him without someone earning it.
One thing I hear sometimes is people claiming that Floyd has a great chin, and I don't know if that's really ever been tested, you know, and I think that's maybe the one wild card is how does he respond when he's hurt? I mean, aside from that brief moment in the Mosley fight, which I think still gets debated as far as how hurt was Floyd actually in that moment, you know, that's kind of the wild card is can Canelo land a punch that could potentially hurt Floyd and force him to, you know, fight, be in a different situation than he's been in.
First off, that's not the most hurt that Floyd's ever been. That's just the one people seem to remember.
Recently.
Yeah, but I mean, like, we saw him get tagged against DeMarcus Corley in the third and fourth rounds. And in both occasions, you know, his legs got a little stiff, same as in the Mosley fight. You know, you saw his knees buckle. But Floyd has incredible balance, and I think he showed in those fights that he has recuperative powers. I mean, the guy's been a professional since 1998, and even barring the fact that, you know, with layoffs, he had about 4 years off over the course of his career. To have never been off his feet legitimately. I mean, there was the Carlos Hernandez knockdown, but, I mean, basically he landed a punch and then put his glove on the ground because it hurt. You know, a self-inflicted, like an owie knockdown isn't quite the same. So, I mean, I think his chin is great. I think the few times he's been tagged, he not only recuperated, Floyd Mayweather fights with a chip on his shoulder. I mean, there's a legitimate meanness to the way he fights. It's something I think you can respect if you watch the older, you know, the old school type fighters. You know, when you hit him, when you catch him with something good, he comes back and beats your ass. And one of the things I like in the Mosley fight is not only did he respond well to being hit, but he didn't do all that patty cake, amateur, handshaking BS. When guys do that with him, he puts leather on them. He's there to fight at all times, and I think there's something about his mentality that goes with his chin that makes him a consummate fighter, even though he doesn't always get recognized that way. I mean, Floyd Mayweather, it's not just his chin. I mean, he's got the whole package, and he's in such great condition that he's able to absorb shots, you know, better than maybe some fighters in his age might otherwise have been. I mean, you look back 20 years, I mean, Pernell Whitaker was about the same size, fought in the same weight division, you know, different style, he was southpaw, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, he couldn't sustain his brilliance into his mid-30s because of outside-the-ring problems. I mean, Floyd's professionalism, you know, it allows him to take shots still at 36, and I think that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and definitely.
When people are going down the road to discredit or criticize Floyd Mayweather, the easy route is, like, looking at his ledger and saying, well, he didn't fight this guy or he didn't fight that guy or blah, blah, blah. But that's one aspect. You know, the attitude is one aspect of his style and him as a fighter that I think is fairly underrated. And, you know, like I wrote an article, maybe like it was right before the Ortiz fight where I basically said, you know, people were saying, oh, Ortiz is going to bully him. He's the bigger guy. And I basically said, look, if you think that Floyd is going to let a guy get away with bullying him, if he's even remotely in the fight size wise, Floyd is going to get nasty. And that's exactly what happened.
He'll put that elbow in your throat. I mean, he'll do all sorts of little old school stuff, you know. And I think that's, you know, it's fun to watch. And as far as who he missed in his career, look, it's true he missed some guys. But I said this on the record for an article for Dave Bryson over at Ring Magazine recently. Floyd, after the second Jose Luis Castillo fight from 2000, you know, from about 2003 through 2005, took the softest, you know, that was the soft run of his career. That's when he fought, you know, Henry Bristelis and Sosa and Sean Bay Mitchell. And that was, you know, I mean, the toughest fight of that whole run was DeMarcus Corley. I mean, it wasn't a very spectacular run. And there were some quality opponents around those weights. I mean, part of the problem was network separation and contracts, but, you know, part of it was just, you know, Floyd was trying to build his audience. I mean, you look back on it, you know, in retrospect, you know, something like the Gatti fight where you knew it was going to be a walkaway early, you know, he took those fights to build a brand. And so it makes sense somewhat in retrospect. But he had that three-year period that, let's be honest, it just kind of sucked. But you look from there, I mean, from the Zab Judah fight forward, what he really missed? I mean, Ricky Hatton was undefeated. Juan Manuel Marquez is the reigning lightweight champion of the world, and he has since proven he can fight at welterweight. He just, you know, he sucks against the kind of style that Floyd Mayweather presents. He's always looked bad against it, and Floyd beat him 12-0. You know, most welterweight champions get credit when they beat the lightweight champion. Floyd doesn't because who the hell knows why. But I mean, in retrospect, that's a
Floyd Mayweather
performance. because he's Floyd Mayweather. He didn't get, I mean, look, when he took his little retirement, he missed Margarito and Cotto when they were red hot. That kind of hurts him a little bit. He offered to fight Shane Mosley before Oscar De La Hoya. Shane was the one that said on national TV that he needed dental work. So, I mean, you know, that it's not always been Floyd. But, I mean, I think, you know, you look at who Floyd's fought over the years. He actually hasn't missed very many guys. At junior lightweight, Casamayor and Freitas were fighting on Showtime. They weren't readily available to him. He could have fought Casamayor later. He wanted him earlier in his career. So, I mean, there are guys he's missed. And in this era, you know, all the big-name guys are going to miss somebody. It's rare that you get an Abner Mares or a Carl Froch where they really do fight everybody. And when they do fight everybody, it's usually somebody like Froch who is going to lose a couple of them. And not because, you know, he took risks, but because he's not, you know, he's not as good as a guy like Andre Ward. But I think Floyd's fought most of the guys he was supposed to fight. And 2003 to 2005 cast a shadow on his career. It has carried with him for many years, you know, that label of ducker. And then, of course, the Pacquiao fight didn't happen, so it gets multiplied because that was the fight everyone wanted to see. And it became much easier to just blame Floyd Mayweather for it because he plays the villain caricature much more than Manny Pacquiao does.
Do you think that kind of hurts Floyd, though, historically, when you compare him to the other fighters and even guys in this generation like Pacquiao and like Bernard Hopkins, when you actually look at the paper resume and what are his greatest wins, what are his greatest moments, you know, does that offset how brilliant and basically flawless that he's been throughout his career?
I mean, maybe it will a little bit. It's going to be a valid critique at the end of his career that there were pockets where he didn't fight, you know, X or Y. The biggest fight of his generation didn't get done when it mattered. And I'm a big believer, you know, whether you think that was more, you know, Bob Arum or Floyd Mayweather or Manny Pacquiao, whoever you want to blame for that, at the end of the day, both of those guys deserve to have that held against them that fight didn't happen. I don't give a damn why. Like, at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is that it didn't happen. And so, you know, you can't evaluate how that fight would have gone just because, you know, from a fanboy perspective, you could say, well, you know, Floyd would have won or Manny would have won. It didn't happen. So you don't know. And if it does happen when they're old and they're trying to cash in and they want to do like a Durant Camacho bullshit fight, you know, that's fine. But you'll never see that fight. You'll never see the real fight. We missed it. We had a chance in March 2010 to see the fight. It didn't happen. The end. From history's perspective, both guys deserve to have that held against them. Now, does it hurt? Who does it hurt more? That it's all how you want to debate it. I mean, you know, how much credit do you give Manny for winning the title at flyweight, sort of as a raw talent prospect who was completely unfinished as a product by then? I mean, you know, you can get into all of these levels of debate. But, you know, yeah, it might hurt him. In comparison to Bernard Hopkins, you go back and look at who Bernard Hopkins had fought by age 36, and you tell me that Floyd is behind where Bernard was at that age,
well,
or even, you know, at
no,
similar points
not.
In his career. But that's what I mean. I mean, Floyd's not done yet. I mean, if he beats Canelo and eventually he adds some version of Manny, or he just keeps beating these younger guys like he's doing, you know, he's going to keep adding to his legacy. I don't even know if it's fair to completely discuss it yet. I mean, Bernard Hopkins enhanced his legacy so much after the age of 40, beginning with the Tarver fight, that it's almost incomprehensible. Like, you look at his quality of opposition from 40 to 48 and compare it to everything that came before it, and the quality of wins that he has, you can make a really strong argument that Bernard did more after 40 in terms of quality wins than he did before. And so what you have before 40 with Bernard is incredible statistics and a couple of big wins. What you have after 40 is some pretty good statistics, some really great wins, and a remarkable quality of opposition that is right up there with guys like Carl Froch and Abner Mares, you know, over the course of his last 10 fights. It's fantastic.
Do you think that the fact that Pacquiao fought, you know, what was six or seven fights against Barrera, Morales, Marquez, really great fighters in those lower weight classes, that did kind of affect the perception of the Mayweather-Pacquiao in the sense that I think a lot of people felt like Pacquiao had the stronger opposition prior to that?
Well, and I mean, you know, he's coming from a lower point on the weight scale. Look, if you're asking me who I would rank higher historically, I'd probably still lean to Pacquiao. I've said this on the record before. You know, I think that the most remarkable run I've seen since Pernell Whitaker in his prime was Manny Pacquiao from the moment he beat Lelo Lituapa to the moment he beat Miguel Cotto. That run from 01 to 09, I mean, he beat, you know, however many. Cotto's going to go to the Hall of Fame. Ricky Hatton might get there, although I personally wouldn't vote for him. Oscar was at the back end of things, but Oscar was also perceived as a heavy favorite in that fight. Manny jumped two weight classes, you know, so he deserves some credit for that fight, even if it wasn't the best Oscar we ever saw. But, I mean, he legitimately beat three Hall of Famers during his run, you know, the big Mexican three. He beat LaDuaba when he was undefeated and a very good fighter. You know, Manny Pacquiao had a remarkable run from junior featherweight to welterweight that, you know, he probably could have done more, but I think that you can make a pretty good argument that, you know, when they got past Cotto, you know, they sort of, his camp blinked a little bit, and they didn't go all the way with the opportunity to be the Henry Armstrong of this generation. They kind of pulled the reins a little bit. They went for the cash. Can't blame them for that, but, you know, they could have done more to make Mayweather too. So I might rank Pacquiao ahead, but in the case of Mayweather, I mean, I think you could rank Mayweather one or two all-time at 130 pounds. He proved that he has the goods to hang with just about any welterweight in history, except maybe Tommy Hearns. I mean, Tommy Hearns is just, you know, that's a bad fight for him. But outside of that, there aren't a ton, you know, and Ray Robinson. But, I mean, there aren't a ton of welterweights that I can see just running Floyd out of the ring. So, you know, and that's from 130 to 140, 147. He's done a little bit at 154. The two previous times are against guys who were coming up in weight like him. This is his first time against, you know, a real sort of junior middleweight tiger. We'll see how he does there. But, I mean, again, he's not done. Right now, I mean, I would so far rank Manny ahead of him historically because of the overall breadth of accomplishment. But we're not done yet.
Well, I told you I had a flyweight question for you.
Bring it.
So not too long ago, when Brian Belloria fought Marquez, I think it was the end of 2012, I think it was December, we had actually both written articles, although you wrote yours first, alluding to the fact that that two world title belts had not seen the same owner in almost 50 years leading up
right to
that. And so, I mean, I just wanted to, like, research it and take it kind of a step further after I had seen a blurb about that. And so, in any event... The flyweight division, needless to say, has always been underrated, and there's probably not a whole lot that can really change that. However, you know, in the last handful of years, the division has really been very good. So I would just ask, who right now in the flyweight division, I mean, there seems to be a somewhat obvious answer for many people, but who do you think is going to come out on top or really show that flyweight could be, you know, something worth looking at for, you know, the boxing public once more?
If all things were equal, if we lived in a better world where the best fights happened all the time, we would pull Chocolatito up from 108, and he would fight Marudi and Thelani, and those are probably the two best fighters right now at 112 pounds. That's my personal opinion. I think Thelani is still probably the class of the class, even though he's inactive. And, you know, but, I mean, you look back, you know, he went tit-for-tat with Nonito Donaire, and Nonito Donaire was a damn beast at flyweight. He went tit-for-tat with him. He was right in that fight. I think you could make a good case that that was an even fight when the cut stopped the fight. And he's looked good since. He came off the floor in his last fight against Nunez. But, again, with his inactivity, you never know. I mean, the thing about flyweight is one day a guy can look sensational. I mean, Lorenzo Parra a few years back was on a great run. He blows out his knee. Then he has weight problems. His career is kaput. I mean, he just couldn't fight anymore. He's a little guy. It was over. And Thelani could be gone by then. Alternately, I think your three guys that you're looking at over the course of the next couple of years who could realistically fight, you could see a Gonzalez-Estrada rematch. And I realize Gonzalez isn't at flyweight yet, but he beat Estrada clean as a sheet. I mean, that was 8-4 straight up. You know, that was a clean win. I think he's the best fighter from 112 on down. Maybe from 115 on down. That's a good fighter. But the other guy that you have to add into that mix is Kazuto Ioka, because Kazuto Ioka, you know, they've kind of pulled back on him a little bit, you know, after he got off to such sort of a blazing start. He beat Sasamurai, he beat Yagashi, and that's all inside of 12 fights. But I think, you know, after you get him a couple more maturation fights and he's still in his early 20s, he's a factor as well, and there's nothing stopping that from eventually happening if they could make some of those kind of fights happen. I mean, you know, we're seeing some good stuff. I mean, Arakawa came over here, made a good impression. got some people interested in what's going on in Japan. You know, we had Takashi Miura against J.O. Thompson last weekend. He looked very good. And we know that Miura is not, you know, the classic 130. I mean, you know, he had Uchiyama down, but otherwise, you know, he got beat in that fight and at 130. So, you know, I think those three is where you're looking for your who is the best flyweight in the world question. Right now, I think that the answer is still pretty obviously Roman Gonzalez.
Yeah, man, Gonzalez Estrada fight, man, that was it was solid stuff, and I do agree that it was a pretty clear win for Chocolatito, but I think that that's just kind of a sign of, you know, what Estrada, who is still fairly young, is, you know, possibly has, you know, going for him in the next couple of years, and that division,
well, but
just, you know, that flyweight in one division, north and south, could just be really interesting in the next three or so years.
But I think the thing about Gonzalez that we have to remember is he's still really young, too. I mean, him and Estrada are both young guys. And Gonzalez has had trouble finding some quality opponents, but a win like Estrada makes him better, too. I mean, we've seen Estrada grow from there. I think you can see Gonzalez grow, too. I'm not sure that Estrada can grow enough to outpace Gonzalez. I mean, Gonzalez might be the best, you know, sub-flyweight fighter we've seen since, you know, the heyday of Michael Carvajal and Ricardo Lopez. I mean, he's right there with that level of fighter. You know, he puts his punches together beautifully. He's got hammers in both gloves. He works well. He's highly skillful. That's just he's a special little fighter.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice little division, and it's unfortunate for anybody who hasn't been following along with it.
And you mentioned something.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and I hope we get to see Akira Yagashi mixed in somewhere. Maybe not on US TV, but at least through, you know, maybe a Fox Deportes or something. I mean, American fans need to see him, too. He's one of the most exciting fighters in the world. He might not be one of the best fighters in the world, but you look at his losses, he's only got one sort of bad loss. He had lost to Eagle Kiowa very early in his career before he was ready, and he was tooth and nail with his eye completely shut against Kazuto Ayoko. That guy is thrilling. He could hang with any of them, and even though I don't think he could beat any of the guys we're talking about, I want to see him get those opportunities, too, and I would love to see hardcore boxing fans get a look at him someplace other than YouTube.
Well, and I was going to say, you brought up the Japanese boxing scene, and we've been talking about the, you know, potential Chinese boxing scene. We had Lupe Contreras on the other day, and he was talking about the show in Macau, and, you know, it's been basically dubbed the untapped market, but something that a lot of boxing fans still don't realize is how big combat sports in general, and especially boxing, are in Japan, and how many really good fighters there are in Japan right now. And, you know, it kind of sucks because you wind up having to find some funky stream at 3 a.m. in order to watch fights live. But at the same time, you know, if you are able to catch these fights later on, it's worth it. These guys are guys
that's me. I'm
100% effort.
I'm a big advocate of YouTube. I have kids, so I'm not watching anything in the middle of the night. But, you know, I'm a big advocate of finding the fights on YouTube. I mean, 2 years ago, the fight of the year was Akira Yagashi and Pornsawan Porpermuke at 105 pounds. You know, boxing scene, you know, we recognize that as the fight of the year. ESPN recognizes it as fight of the year. It was the fight of the year. I know other outlets may have selected, you know, Ortiz Burdo or the Rodriguez Wolak fight. Those were good fights too, but they weren't at that caliber of fight. And that's the kind of action sometimes that you miss. But it's a reminder that boxing, you know, it's funny because it has so many different markets and it's easy to be parochial and not realize just how big the tapestry is for boxing. There are great fighters in Africa and Thailand and Korea and Japan over the years that Americans almost never see. And you know, it's part of the beauty of the sport that you can see greatness in boxing in all corners of the world and have a piece of that greatness almost all to yourself. The advances in technology have at least shrunk the world enough to where you can share it with the people who really want to see it. I mean, imagine what it would be like, you know, if a guy like Yoko Gushikin was in his prime right now. I mean, everybody would be able to watch all his fights on YouTube, and that's a great thing. So, I mean, even if we don't get to the markets closer together, at least the world has shrunk enough for people to see some of these great, great smaller fighters from other countries, including Japan.
Yeah, definitely. And we probably have a little over 10 minutes to go, but I was going to ask James if you have anything else to ask Mr. Roll that I was going to ask him about last weekend, but your goal.
Well, kind of tying in with last weekend, I guess. What's your thoughts on this landscape from like 160 to 168, you know, including Golovkin and Ward, and how do you see things playing out there? And is there going to be a big mega fight at the end of the road?
I don't know. I mean, look, right now, the two biggest fights from 160 to 175, at least as far as, you know, combining the quality of potential action, quality of matchup, and where we rank guys. You know, I would probably say, I think Sergey Kovalev is the best light heavyweight in the world right now. I think Bernard Hopkins could give him some technical problems. That would be a very interesting fight. I don't count Hopkins out there. He's good against punchers. Although this is a different skill level of puncher than we've seen him against recently. I mean, this is, you know, Kovalev's skill level is something that people are just beginning to wake up to. He reminds me a little bit of Larry Holmes in the way he utilizes his jab, the way he brings it up and down, the way he whips that left to the body. Larry Holmes always had that underrated left underneath to the body. He reminds me a little bit of that, but, with, you know, with hammers in his glove. So you've got him at 175. I don't see anybody there. I think he would walk to Adonis Stevenson. I think he'd knock him out in two or three rounds to win, you know, the lineal light heavyweight title. I think he's right there. You know, it's you know, Hopkins, Stevenson, Kovalev, that's a good glut. The one guy who really stands out there as a potential Ward opponent right now is probably Kovalev down the road. I prefer to see Ward move up rather than wait. I don't know how long Golovkin's going to wait to move to 168. As far as 160, it's a fun class if it's matched right, but I think there's a humongous gap in talent right now. I think there's Golovkin. Martinez was there. I'm not sure if he still is. I think Martinez might have shrunk back to the pack, but I think it's Golovkin and everybody else right now. But I think Golovkin has to fight Martinez for, you know, he deserves a crack at history's middleweight championship. Right now he's still got a pretty, you know, it's kind of a weak reign as a middleweight titleist for Golovkin. You know, he just needs more quality opponents. But, I mean, those are the three that I think you mix and match. And the way you mix and match them is, you know, Golovkin Ward is one fight and Kovalev Ward is the other fight. And everything else, you know, you can just make a lot of fun fights with different guys. Carl Froch mixes in with anybody. I think he's in tough with George Groves this fall. It would not surprise me if Groves pulled off the upset. Carl Froch is not a young man with his style, and Groves is a very good fighter. Groves could very well be a big part of this conversation by the end of the year.
How would you covered a lot of ground there.
Yeah, what's that?
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No. I missed your question there. Sorry.
Oh, I was just saying. Let's just say hypothetically.
Covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, if they made Ward Kovalev tomorrow, which way are you leaning?
It's pick'em fight. I'm not sure. It's a pick'em fight. You know, it all depends. If Ward can, you know, get inside and maul Kovalev and frustrate him, take him some rounds, you know, he's in a good position. If Kovalev can establish his jab and force Ward to work to get inside, he had a hell of a fight there. Because I'm not sure Ward has the power to keep Kovalev off. Now, that's assuming that Ward would go up to 175. I mean, you know, he could try to starve Kovalev and make him live on saltines and water and probably beat him up. But if he took the real challenge and went to 175, that's a pick'em fight.
And what about if Golovkin goes 68?
I don't know.
Fight Ward.
I mean, Golovkin's good. We haven't seen him against the same caliber of opposition yet that Ward has seen. I mean, Ward, you know, for some of the criticisms he gets for being inactive, some of his style criticisms, the guy has lights out wins over Mikkel Kessler, Carl Froch, and Chad Dawson. He's got another solid win over a perennial contender in Saki Obika. He beat Abraham easy. And, you know, Abraham's not easy to beat unless you're a certain caliber of fighter. So, you know, I would still lean Andre Ward there. You know, he doesn't have the sort of height and length that Kovalev does. But, I mean, you know, Golovkin is really getting his legs underneath him right now professionally. He's getting that momentum and that experience. You know, that could be a pick-em fight a year from now. Right now I'd still lean pretty heavily to Andre Ward.
Yeah, I think you could argue that Kovalev's probably achieved more in the light heavyweight division than Golovkin has in the middleweight division, just in terms of who they've beaten and having the.
Oh, that's not even a hard argument.
Yeah.
That's not even a hard argument. Kovalev's two big wins are better than anything on Golovkin's resume so far. But I think, you know, Golovkin's resume will catch up to his talent in short order.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And I have a quick question about this past weekend. What would you say was the fight of the weekend?
Ooh, I mean, I liked Gail Barker a lot. I thought that was good. The heavyweight fight was a lot of fun. For just a pure action standpoint, I thought the ESPN card was the card of the weekend. How often do you see a fight card where you got 10K in a baseball stadium, like a real stadium. And in all three fights, the winner got off the floor to win. Hey, that's crazy. So, you know, that was good stuff. You know, I think the heavyweight fight and Gail Barker were probably the two most exciting fights of the weekend. Thompson and Miura was a little bit competitively one-sided. The scores were closer than the fight probably. But that was, I mean, there was some brutal shots landed in that fight. I mean, you know, three knockdowns, that was a good fight. But, you know, I'd probably go with the heavyweight fighter Gail Barker as far as the fight of last weekend.
How did you think that should have been scored?
Oh, you can flip a coin. I mean, I kind of leaned towards Gail. I thought Gail won the 12th round. I thought, you know, that might have put him ahead by a smidge. But I had no problem with the final outcome. I mean, you know, when you have close rounds, you know, you have close rounds. Somebody's got to win one. And especially when people are encouraged. I mean, they don't do even rounds anymore. You could have called that fight a draw. I'd have been fine with that, too. You know, both guys came out winners. They made fans. And they made fans happy on top of it. So, you know, what more could you really ask for?
Well, dude, we got carried away talking boxing, and I forgot to ask you, and I did want to ask you, for people listening, for anyone interested or anybody, you know, who's going to be listening later, I wanted you to kind of quickly break down what the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board is and what you guys do.
Well, basically, you know, myself, Tim Starks, who, you know, of course, is the head honcho at Kingsbury Rules, and Springs Toledo, who writes for the Sweet Science, you know, right there with you, Pat. I mean, you guys, when I want to read good historical pieces, you two are two of the guys I'm going to. Great research.
Well, thank you.
Well, basically,
I take that
as
a huge compliment because Springs is
good. No, I love reading your stuff, but The point of TBRB is, and we're trying to think of a more user friendly nickname right now. It's a mouthful, you know. TBRB just doesn't come out right, but you know, the point is, look, we all understand. There's a lot of belts in boxing. You know, belts have their place. They're important economic markers in the sport. You know, they help people make money. They get guys from point A to point B as they work their way towards bigger fights. I get that. You know, you're not going to take that away. But I think there has to be a place where you can protect sort of the lineage of the titles, the history of the sport. I mean, there is still something beautiful about the fact that you can connect, you know, Bernard Hopkins' middleweight reign on some level to the reigns of Carlos Monzon and Sugar Ray Robinson and Harry Gripp. There's something beautiful about the fact that Adonis Stevenson right now can lay claim to the same title that Michael Spinks had. And it doesn't mean that they're as good as the fighters that came before, but it's that historical interconnected tissue. And I think it's important to have a place where fans can go to see, you know, sort of an unbiased take on the top 10 and to sort of, you know, be able to look and say, who is history's champion right now? Like, who is the guy that historically, you know, owns that crown? And I think that's important. And that's sort of where that grew out of. All of us were involved, of course, with the ring ratings panel before. Ring decided to sort of broaden their rules a little bit, allow circumstances in theory, if not in practice, it hasn't happened yet, but allow in theory where a number two rated fighter could fight number five and be rated as the world champion of a division. That's not the way you should do it. You know, maybe it's a purist position, but that's fine. I mean, that's kind of the point. It should be an honor to be connected to that historical tissue, and that's where we grew out of. And we're in it for the long haul. I mean, we're not, you know, you won't see all of us, you know, going nuts all the time, selling it. You know, the product is there. Over time, we would hope that there will be more recognition for what we're doing, and that people can look to us as a reliable source for you know, fair ratings and a fair reflection of what history's world championship picture is right now. And I think that's a valid mission, and you know, I think that's fun. And as somebody who loves the history of the sport, that's something I want to protect. So, you know, I'm proud to be a part of it. I was proud to help, you know, found that with Tim and Springs, and look forward to doing it for many years to come.
Well, and at the end of the day, you know, I'm not going to lie, like probably most people, I was skeptical because I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know, you know, what you guys were hoping to accomplish. But now that it's had some time to kind of marinate, I think it's become clear that, you know, it's consistent. The viewpoint is consistent, and however you feel about it, people need to just, you know, kind of look it up yourself, make your own decision.
Absolutely, we've got a great panel. We've got a great panel of arbiters from all over the world. You know, there are multiple international voters. You know, we have healthy discussion every week about how, you know, about how the fighters should be ranked. Sometimes people agree, sometimes they disagree. That's fine. It's very hard, you know, it's hard to not do boxing ratings subjectively, especially with the sport spread as internationally as it is, you know, but we do the best we can, and we hope to provide that alternative to people. Not everybody's going to embrace it. You know, the ring titles, you know, even before some of the editorial changes that people found controversial, you know, they were, you know, there were always people who didn't accept them. They had their flaws all along. You know, they never embraced, you know, some of the lineage that pre-existed their new policy. You know, there's probably never going to be a perfect option, but we would hope that we can be a positive alternative that exists for a long period of time and acts as, if nothing else, is just a positive resource for people.
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, at the end of the day, like I said, people should just be looking it up for themselves. They don't have to necessarily agree with the premise or, you know, but I think that what it was born from was a legitimate stance against something, against basically a policy from Ring Magazine that a lot of us disagree with, really. So, in any event, that basically concludes our show.
And I mean, personally,
sorry.
Nothing against.
No, sir, we have time, so if you want to keep going, go.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, you know, from a personal perspective, I mean, it's nothing even against the guys at Ring. I, you know, both of their editors there, I consider professional friends. I mean, Mike and Doug, you're great guys. It's just for me, it was just a disagreement with approach, and I think it was a fundamental disagreement that had to be addressed. You know, but at the end of the day, you know, there's still a desire out there to know who the real world champions are, and no, this isn't the biggest problem for the sport. It's not, you know, it's not what took away the economic footing of the sport in the United States. It's not affecting the markets in some places overseas, but I think there's still value to it. Boxing, like baseball, really is a sport that derives much from its history, and its history is colorful, and its history, you know, for all of its blemishes, still has a great degree of honor to it. And I think what we can do to protect that is a thing of value over the duration of time.
Well, and actually, a quick question before we shut it down. So what is your guys' sanctioning fee going to be this coming year? What is it going to be, like a couple sandwiches and like a beer? Or?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's about the same as last year. You know, it doesn't cost anybody a thing to get ranked by us. You know, we're not handing out extra belts, you know, at least not right now. I mean, maybe sometime down the road, if we could find a way to honor the fighters who sort of win history titles, maybe that could be something that's discussed, you know, later on down the road. But right now, what's important is to give people a free, you know, honest alternative out there to, you know, some of the sanctioning bodies and some of the crazy races that you see out there. You know, guys didn't rank number one without fighting in a division or without fighting anyone ranked in a division. I mean, you know, there are belts, and then there are world champions. And I think that the boxing fan has become educated to that over the last 20 years. When I was a kid, you know, we were just beginning to realize how sort of silly it is. But, I mean, it is silly after a while. I mean, you're not a world champion for winning some of these fights. You're a guy with a belt. And if you can use that to get on TV and make some money, good for you. But you got to beat the right guys to be the champ. And being the champ still matters. That's why, you know, that's why the term champion still has value in this sport.
And it should. It really should. Yeah. It shouldn't be interchangeable with titleist or belt holder, really.
Well, and I mean, you know, in the 90s, there was sort of, you know, a reflexive action to sort of make pound for pound matter more because of how devalued the titles became. But at the end of the day, pound for pound is stupid. I mean, you know, you're not going to see a fight between Sergey Kovalev and Roman Gonzalez. So how the hell do you know who really is the better fighter? You don't. Boxing happens in divisions, and that's where it's always happened. You catch weights aside, you know. But boxing happens in weight classes, and you know, guys who can win titles in multiple weight classes define themselves against those weight classes and against people who travel similar roads in those weight classes. And great middleweights are ultimately compared to other great middleweights. And how they rank pound for pound isn't as important as what they did at 160 pounds because that's the thing that you can actually evaluate in a sort of concrete fashion. Everything else is, you know, it's just something to talk about at the barbershop.
Yeah, well, everybody needs a little bit of barbershop discussion every so often, I guess. But, no, I agree.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, it is about the history, and it is about recognition, like recognition of real tasks and not things manufactured by folks who are collecting money, basically.
Yeah. Gennady Golovkin. Gennady Golovkin right now, we think he might be the best middleweight in the world. But until he beats Sergio Martinez in a boxing ring, as long as Martinez is the reigning champion, he does not have that connection to Mickey Walker, Harry Greb, and Freddie Steele, and the great middleweights of the past. But, you know, with a single punch or a single night, he can build that string to the past. And that is a remarkable thing. And very few other sports have that. I mean, you know, at the end of the year, there's only one Super Bowl champion, and you're connected to the tissue of other Super Bowl champions. That's how you're compared in football. You know, in baseball, you have World Series champions. In this sport, you have world champions. And you have the men who have stood out against history, and to join their club, you got to accomplish what they did.
Agreed. Well, Cliff, thank you so much for joining us, man. It was a fun time, and I'm glad I got to ask you a lightweight question or two, because
hey,
I
absolutely.
Was hoping
hey, you
know,
thanks a lot.
Anytime you guys want to do it again, it was my pleasure. I look forward to this, and I'm glad we were able to do it.
Well, thanks again, Cliff, and
thanks.
Anybody, again, who's not familiar, boxingscene.com is where Cliff writes, and he's on the chair of the Transnational Boxing Rankings Board. So check out their website, tbrb.org, I believe, and judge for yourself. For James Foley of Bad Left Hook, I'm Patrick Connor of QueensberryRules.com. Everybody, thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.